This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 22nd of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 63rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's that time of year when the world falls in love with port, cheese, birds with bacon across their backs. Gift wrap and goodwill are extended to all men, especially those bearing gifts. Anyone still give myrrh as a Christmas present? No, didn't think so. It's Christmas, cats. Rejoice for the real reason, or just for the parties, or just for the time off, or just for the heady scent of wine mulling. Can you sniff it wafting out of our studio? Come on in, have a look at what's in Monocle's cultural grotto. We'll host pal of the show, a funny boy and a wise man of all things comedy. James Mullinger joins us to talk through his comedy highlights of the year and a roundup of the inescapable swathe of Christmas funnies.
Is this tightly honed, beautiful stand-up? No, it's the chitter-chatter stuff in between the material that wouldn't be good enough to make a normal DVD.
We'll be dispatching our Santa's little helpers to tell us what seasonal sellers the record shops of the world are shifting.
Hi, this is Kenji Hall in Tokyo. I wanted to find out what was going to sell well here in Japan over the holidays. And I also wanted to get off the beaten track a little bit, a little non-J-pop.
And Christmas is all about theatre, so we'll speak to legendary thespian Trader Faulkner about his life and career.
This is a very respectable establishment. We're a Sloan telephone exchange. Breakfast will be brought in bed, and you must love my pussy.
All that, plus we head to Chicago to hear about some festive radio plays being brought to the stage, and we meet the artist who's recreated Bethlehem Church in Berlin. That's all here on this Culture Christmas special with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So to kick things off, here's a festive album we're excited about. This is Tracy Thorn, known to many as the lead singer in Everything But the Girl. She's released a Christmas album this year called Tinsel and Lights, and this is Snow and Sun. I was getting me down. That was Tracy Thorn with Snow and Sun from her album Tinsel and Lights. And we'll hear a bit more from that later on in the show. All right, we'll get our first guest out of the grotto now. Look, it's stand-up comedian, journalist and comedy connoisseur James Mullinger to give us a bit of a review of 2012 in funnies and tell us what we might well be laughing at in the new year.
I love Christmas and I love the Culture Show.
Everyone loves culture. They're kind of inextricably intertwined because obviously Christmas is an exceptional cultural treat. But in your trade, the comedy trade, for most people, that means a stack of stand-up DVDs. This is the time when stand-up comedians who've had their 15 moments of fame on panel shows and things get their DVDs out in time for Christmas, right?
Yeah, there's about 30, 40 DVDs on the market at the moment. I've sat through all of them. Some of them are magnificent, some less so. And of course, the great thing about the comedy boom is it does mean that you can, essentially be a panelist on a show like Mott in a Week and suddenly put out a DVD. Whereas in America, you really do have to be a bona fide stand-up legend to do that.
So this is the kind of thing where people will see, go, oh, yeah, that's that guy with the goatee from a well-known panel show. I'll buy his DVD for my son for Christmas. It's as easy as that.
And it's a gift thing, isn't it? It's basically, and I'm not, without casting aspersions on any of the brilliant comics involved, it's a lazy gift thing. And obviously Peter Kay is famously the most horrific when it comes to being shamelessly cashing in on things. In the past, he's actually released the same set twice on two different DVDs. Without revealing this, it was merely a different performance of the same material. This year, he's released a new one, which is, again, people talking about why he's such a genius, intercut with 55 minutes of brand new stand-up. Is this tightly honed, beautiful stand-up? No, it's the chitter-chatter stuff in between the material that wouldn't be good enough to make a normal DVD.
As you say, there's 50 stand-up DVDs weighing down the shelves in HMV. What are the three that people might want to go out and buy?
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, that what's happening in the States right now is that a lot of the big-name comedians like Aziz Ansari and Louis C.K. is that they are filming the shows themselves rather than getting Comedy Central or someone else to film them and thus getting very little of the money. They're filming it themselves and then releasing it for download. And, of course, you can't give a download as a gift. But Louis C.K. live at the Beacon Theatre would be the greatest gift you could give anyone if that member of your family is happy to receive what looks like a blank CD with a MP4 burnt on it. But in all seriousness, this is the thing that I think has changed the industry, that people are filming the stuff themselves, doing it themselves, themselves.
Excuse me, let's talk about next year.
Yeah.
We mentioned Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, he's doing another record-breaking tour. But what's great about Izzard's tour is he's doing all the UK arenas, but then he's doing Latvia, Estonia, Switzerland, Belgium. It's set to break world records, and it will no doubt be an amazing show, and that would definitely be the DVD to buy next Christmas. 2013 is shaping up already just to be a brilliant year for comedy. I mean, in January alone, This Is 40 comes out, which is Judd Apatow's sequel to Knocked Up.
And this is sort of, I mean, would it be fair to say this is kind of like that roustabout kind of college comedy that's sort of grown up? I mean, This Is 40 is a 40-year-old man making a script 15 years after he sort of, you know, he did his first kind of college campus.
Exactly, yeah. And this is what's great, I think, about Judd Apatow, is that he can do the stoner stuff brilliantly, as we know. Knocked Up obviously had that, but it did have the grown-up element as well. And I think most married couples looked at the scenes with Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann and related to it. So to give them a whole movie is a masterstroke. And the film itself, Megan Fox has been added to the mix. Chris O'Dowd has been added to it, who is now, you know, gone from being, you know, a bit part British sitcom player into now being an international player, thanks to his brilliant performance in Bridesmaid.
While we're on the movie tip, we saw I Give It a Year in the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
And we both quite enjoyed it, I think. Maybe you can fill us in who directed it, who's in it.
Yeah, it's the directorial debut of Dan Mazur, who helped create all of Sacha Baron Cohen's characters with him. They were at school together. They developed Borat and Ali G together. Dan Mazur was, of course, a producer and writer on the 11 o'clock show and worked on Borat and the Ali G movies. He is doing his first movie as director. It's a romantic comedy done with working title, but it is everything you would expect it not to be. I met Dan last week and we were talking about it, and he was saying that he obviously gets lots of offers for movies and was talking about doing something working title, and he was like, how much can I skewer the genre without pissing off working title? And I think what's so brilliant about the film, I Give It a Year, is that
when
it
we
functions...
talk about working title, when we talk about this kind of thing, we're talking about sort of when Richard
Love
Curtis
actually,
territory.
Yeah, Love Actually, Notting Hill and so forth. What's so great about what he's done is that it does function as a rom-com. My wife loves rom-coms. She would enjoy it.
I love rom-coms.
Yeah, I love rom-coms. But I also like, you know, vicious, biting satire. And what's brilliant about this is it merges the two and it functions as both, which is a very, very difficult thing to pull off.
It's sort of a post-Bridesmaids movie.
Yeah.
Because the female characters in it are strong and funny and, you know, kind of wear the trousers. It's an interesting thing how there is such a thing as a post-Bridesmaids genre now.
Absolutely. And in some ways that is a post-feminist thing whereby you are talking about, you know, female characters that are not stereotypes. They're all in there as specific characters with different depths and different layers. And this is a perfect example of that. I mean, the most important thing about it is that regardless of the fact that it functions as a rom-com and blah, 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 is that it is ridiculously funny from beginning to end. Stephen Merchant is magnificent. Yeah. We were talking earlier about the fact that Stephen Merchant, yes, he is playing the classic Stephen Merchant character, the persona that he has developed. But who cares when you're laughing this hard?
We're going to...
That was a joke.
While we're talking post-feminism, we're talking interesting, strong female characters and the rest of it, I think we should talk about Veep. This is Amanda Iannucci, the thick of it maestro, the Alan Partridge maestro in the UK, moved to HBO in the USA. I guess, is this a co-production or is this a Sky Atlantic thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Sky Atlantic with HBO. Julia Louis-Dreyfus from Seinfeld is famously the star of the show. I believe she won an Emmy or a Golden Globe for it recently. The second series is coming, which of course couldn't come at any better time given that the thick of it has just ended. The first season of Veep was very well received, mainly down to the fact that, you know, like the thick of it is extremely clever and is a brilliantly kind of observed satire of American politics. But as with all of these things, just the most important thing of all is that it is just extremely funny.
And that's a really tough trick to pull off. Actors can probably come to and fro across the Atlantic. I think writing and conceiving of things, that's really tough. When the film version of The Thick of It in the Loop made its way across the Atlantic, which is, again, was an Amanda Iannucci thing, it was good but not as good as The Thick of It. And I kind of thought this might be the case with Veep. I guess being a political nerd and having a series to play with rather than an hour and a half feature film, I guess that's something that Iannucci can get his teeth into.
Agreed, but I also think that there's not much precedent for a British actor who has been successful to go over to the States and then immediately be the lead or in charge in something. For a writer and producer to go over there and immediately be top dog. He wasn't a British producer and went over to be a script supervisor and then worked his way up. He went over as the big guy.
There are two things that I wanted to talk about quickly before we finished up. I wanted to talk very quickly about my favourite stand-up comedian. I think he might be yours as well, Stuart Lee. He's got a DVD out in time for Christmas. He hasn't. The mother of all lefty, liberal, anti-capitalist comedians has got a DVD out in time for Christmas, it probably is the funniest.
It absolutely is the funniest. And that is what is so absolutely beautiful about the Stuart Lee DVD, is that it does everything it can to be subversive and different and difficult and dividing and alienating and show ruining. And ultimately, at the end of it all you have is a 2-hour absolute laugh fest. And yeah, we could sit here till dawn analysing this DVD. But ultimately, you are sat there, and this is absolutely unheard of in comedy. You are sat there laughing in hysterics like Michael McIntyre was tickling your balls with a feather. And at the same time, all that can go through your mind is just, oh my God, he just did this. Oh my God, he just did that. He twisted that. He subverted that. He thought that. He screwed with that. He played with that. I mean, Stuart Lee is one of the greatest British comedians of all time.
Should we say what it's called?
Yes, we should say
maybe
what it's
this is going to be the punchline to your joke. We should say it's called Carpet Remnant World.
It is called Carpet
Remnant World. Which I think is an amazingly uncommercial title. Well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he doesn't. He's not trying to push it. But to be clear, yeah, the Stuart Lee DVD is fantastic. I saw the show live. I've seen it on DVD. There is no better stand-up DVD that you can buy this Christmas.
That's Stuart Lee's Carpet Remnant World. And before we go, we should tell you where you can see James Mullinger performing. If you are in London on the 14th of January next year, Stand Up For Women.
Indeed. It's a fundraiser. It's the second fundraiser I've put
together.
Where's this
at? The Bloomsbury Theatre.
It's at the lovely Bloomsbury Theatre, which is one of London's loveliest theatres. It's for a charity called Eves, who do amazing work for vulnerable women, women that have been affected by violence, trafficking and so forth. And they're an amazing, amazing charity. The lineup is staggeringly good. You've got Sarah Pascoe, you've got Robin Ince, you've got Mary Bourke, you've got Holly Walsh. I mean, the list is absolutely endless. Shappi Khorsandi. And most importantly, me. Me.
James Mullinger, thank you so much as ever. Comedian and comedy critic, we can call you, and comedy commentator. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your Christmas list with us and looking into the comedy snow globe.
That was James Mullinger there. And you can see James and some of his famous and amusing pals at London's Bloomsbury Theatre for the Stand Up Women event on the 14th of January. For those just joining us, you're listening to the Christmas special of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We love a bit of Christmas vinyl here on Culture, and we love an independent record store to sell us that festive disc too. So we dispatched some of our team around the world to find out what their local store recommends as a festive soundtrack. Later we'll hear from Zurich and Sydney, but first to Tokyo and New York. Take it away.
Hi, this is Kenji Hall in Tokyo. I wanted to find out what was going to sell well here in Japan over the holidays. And I also wanted to get off the beaten track a little bit, a little non-J-pop. So I went down the street and around the corner to Beams Records and got a few recommendations. So first off, we have Masayoshi Fujita's album Stories. This is the first vibraphone solo album by the Berlin-based Japanese artist, who's also known as El Fog. It's a quiet, lyrical album, and he combines static, electronic, sonar, and what he calls textured noises with his unusual playing. And they also recommended Eiko Ishibashi's I'm Armed. This is her fifth album. She's a pianist. She also plays flute, drums, vibraphone, and a variety of other instruments. The folks at Beams Records described this album to me as music that's like a snowy landscape in any country.
Hi, my name is Josh Maydell. I'm a co-owner of Other Music. We're an independent record shop in Lower Manhattan. We've been here since 1995, and we sell all sorts of underground music, old, new, reissues, used records too, and collectibles, vinyl and CD, a really broad cross-section of the best underground music from every era. A really big buzz band in 2012 was a band from Tampa, Florida called Merchandise. their second record called Desire came out, and it got a really huge blog buzz. Very melancholy, very emotional pop, and it's a great record that was really impossible to get most of the year because it came out on a very small label called Katorga Works, and it was vinyl only and very hard to find. It's a great record that a lot of people have been listening to online, but it's nice that we finally can get copies of it. Christmas albums are not always our thing. We're a little more of an underground shop. But there's a new one this year that we've been doing pretty well with, which is Tracy Thorne from Everything But The Girl did a really great solo album of sort of non-traditional Christmas songs.
Maybe this Christmas will mean something more. Maybe this year love will appear deeper than ever before.
She covers a lot of newer Christmas material, songs by people like Sufjan Stevens and Jack White. It's like a beautiful album that I think in some ways captures the maybe the lost spirit of Christmas. It's kind of melancholy, very sweet and beautiful, but not too sugary, and it's a nice one.
Maybe this Christmas.
Great minds think alike, eh? That was Tracy Thorne with Maybe This Christmas, ending that report there from New York. And we'll be hearing some more tracks from Tracy, our album of the week, later on. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and it's a Christmas special. We're back with some festive radio drama in Chicago. Stay tuned.
Whether you're looking for gift ideas, clothing, or something for the home, we can help. Monocle has a selection of beautifully appointed shops in New York, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and our latest edition in College Street, Toronto. Scarves by Drake, wallets by Ettinger, and wine cups by Hakkisan are just a small selection of Monocle's collaborations with designers from around the world. Plus, if you've got any gaps in your collection of Monocle back issues, well, we can help with that too. So do pop in and say hello at any of our Monocle shops.
Welcome back to a Christmas special of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Chicago is known for both great theatre and traditional Midwestern values. It seems fitting then that the city's famously broad shoulders can carry not one but two live radio play productions of It's a Wonderful Life, the warm-hearted 1947 Frank Capra film starring Jimmy Stewart that's become an American holiday tradition. The American Theatre Company first staged the radio play in 2004, and 5 years later, a group of ATC players split off and founded their own theatre. Ever since, each company has produced its own version of It's a Wonderful Life every holiday season to mostly packed houses. On the eve of the opening night, Monocle's David Lepesca visited the show's creator, Marty Higginbotham, who directed this year's production at the American Blues Theatre.
Hee-haw! Hello, Sam. How are you?
Oh, great. Gee, it's good to hear your voice again.
You know, it's rude to talk on the phone when you got a guest.
Oh, well, that's awfully sweet of you, Sam.
Well, that's rude.
There's an old friend of yours here, George Bailey.
You mean old Mossback George?
Yes, old Mossback.
We started in 2002 and did a one-night reading, I believe, and just sort of invited family and friends, and it was a lot of fun. Second year, people really liked it, so I think we did two performances. And then after that, Damon said, well, this should be a full-fledged production, and asked if anyone was interested in directing it. And I stepped up and said, absolutely, I would love to do this.
Here's Mary.
No, wait a minute. I want to speak to both of you. Tell Mary to get on the extension.
Mother's on the extension.
I am not.
From the very beginning, I added additional elements that weren't necessarily scripted about how we were going to handle the pre-show, what we were going to do in the audience breaks and all that sort of stuff. And then as it went on, we slowly realized that we wanted to do something a little bit different with the show. We moved toward our own adaptations and made our own changes and slowly evolved into our own script of the show.
Could you give me some examples of these changes and these directorial decisions as well?
Well, sure. The directorial from the top, it was really important for me tearing down that fourth wall, and first of all, not only tearing down the fourth wall, but making people feel really welcome and warm and a part of the experience. The one thing that we've discovered from very early on is that as a radio stage play, so you've got the world created of a radio studio, but you've got an actual live audience sitting there watching. The difference is to keep that story out. It's always an actor's instinct to make eye contact with the person that's their scene partner. But when you put that microphone and then that audience on the other side of them, it is a much more compelling experience for the audience if the actor plays their scene partner out in front of them in the ether. Because it almost gives the audience a filmic experience. It's almost like an over-the-shoulder shot. And also allows them to imagine more, because as soon as those actors turn to each other, it cuts them off. The fourth wall's sort of back.
Hey, Ernie.
Hiya, George.
Hey, Bert.
That's one fancy piece of luggage you got there.
And one of these days, you're going to see this bag all covered with travel labels. Italy, Baghdad, Samarkand. Hey, Ernie, how about taking me home in style?
Sure, Your Highness, hop in the cab.
Well, it wasn't about creating characters. You'll see some other adaptations where they create sort of characters that are the radio actors, and there's a whole subplot going on and all sorts of stuff like that. And I really wanted it to be just an honest, direct communication with the audience. And so we started there. First of all, I wanted the chance for, you know, people to feel really engaged and experience as if it was a radio show. So I came up with the idea of audiograms where they would, you know, people would have a chance to write a little message for people to be read out over the air, and I'm putting that in air quotes. And then the thought of actually getting actual businesses that we could write jingles for, because not only would it have been fun and the audience always gets a good chuckle out of it, but it's a revenue generator as well too, so that's been great.
So you met Jimmy Stewart when you were a kid. Did you always have a great affection for the show, for this film?
Yeah, I've always loved the film. And so I had a blast, actually acted in it those first 2 years. We did just the one-up performances of it. And so, yeah, it wasn't even a question when Damon offered it. I mean, I couldn't believe he was offering it up, because he loves the film so much. But I think it was just the way it fell in the season. He was already directing a couple of shows at that time, and so sort of offered it up. And so, I jumped at it. There's so much in the film. There's just so much there to be mined. And even a decade later, every time we come back into the rehearsal process, there's a new moment to discover. There's something to change. There's something to pull out. There's a new scene to add in. There's a way to reapproach the scene that keeps even the rehearsal process exciting.
Wasn't me talking. I'd say that you're the prettiest girl in town.
Well, why don't you say it?
Well, I don't know. Well, maybe I will. How old are you anyway?
18.
18?
Too young or too old?
Oh, no. Just right.
Since 2009, there's been two of these going on.
Yep.
And they've both done well, it seems like, you know, sold out shows and stuff. Why do you think it's done so well? People here in Chicago seem to love this show. Why has it done so well so far?
We're at such a huge advantage because the film is so wonderful. The original story is so wonderful that you'd kind of have to work hard to really, really screw it up. A lot of people could do an adequate job of it, right? But you'd have to really work hard to screw it up. And so I think those things combined with a city on the whole that is a little bit more welcoming and open and ready to receive.
Dance by the light of the moon.
Just like an organ.
That was Marty Higginbotham speaking to David LaPesca there in Chicago. Still to come in part two of this Christmas culture special, we'll hear from some independent record stores in Zurich and Sydney about their festive choices, we'll meet legendary old thesp Trader Faulkner, and we'll check out the artist who's recreated the Church of Bethlehem in Berlin. Mitzpah, anyone? First, though, more from our festive album of the week. This is Tracy Thorn with In the Cold, Cold Night from her Christmas LP, Tinsel and Lights. From her Christmas album, Tinsel and Lights, that was Tracy Thorn with In the Cold, Cold Night, originally done, of course, by the White Stripes. Trader Faulkner now, a legend of the golden age of the post-war London stage, with a waspish wit, an amusing aphorism, and a gossipy anecdote about the great, good, and sometimes ghastly, the thespian came into Midori House to talk about his new memoir, Inside Trader, which takes us from his Australian upbringing via a name change gifted him by Gielgud to preeminence on the boards.
On the front cover, there's a nice quote from Sir Peter Hall. Gossipy, irreverent and extremely funny, like the man himself. Trader, welcome to the Culture Show.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether I'm old and sad, but funny. I mean, I'm one of life's clowns.
We should start off by introducing you properly as Ronald Faulkner. And we should ask you how you got the name Trader.
A wonderful director called Tyrone Guthrie. He brought me over to England.
Man, that's a good name, isn't it? You don't get names like that anymore. Tyrone Guthrie.
Oh, God, he was an Irishman. And he directed Olivia and all, and Gielgud and all those people in the great seasons of 1944. And Guthrie was the director, and he came out to Australia to discuss the possibility of a national theatre. And he was interviewing young hopefuls, and I went along, and he said, "Well, young man, what's your name?" And I said, "Ronald Faulkner, sir." And he said, "What have you done?" And I told him, "I've done a bit of radio and, you know, done one or two plays." And I said, "At the moment, I'm in The Merry Wives of Windsor." He said, "I saw that last night. You weren't in it." I said, "Yes, I was." He said, "What did you play?" I said, "Dr. Caius, the French quack." He said, "Caius?" He said, no, impossible." Well, I said, "Hear me photos. Have a look." He said, "My God." He said, "You're the best thing in it." He said, "Was that you?" I said, "Yeah, that's me." And to cut a long story short, he said, "Look, here's my card. If you can get to England in May next year," this was 1949, "if you can get to England May next year," he said, "I'll cast you in my play. I'm doing a play called Top of the Ladder, which I wrote, which is going to star John Mills." Oh, I said, yeah, I've seen him. He's a film star. He said, yes, he does that, among other things. So I came over, got on a boat, arrived in London, and I went to Ebury Street for digs.
Quite a nice address.
Very good address.
Very genteel already, Trader.
The door opened and the voice said, "Yes." And I said, I'm an actor looking for digs. He said, "Yes, this is a very respectable establishment. We're a Sloan Telephone Exchange. Breakfast will be brought in bed and you must love my pussy." And at that moment, a sad, beautiful old grey cat came out from under a skirt. So I picked up pussy and I said, "Don't worry, darling. I love you, pussy."
And he never looked back.
And she said, "What?" I said, "What's its name?" She said, "Furry Comfort." So Furry Comfort and I became friends.
That's a terrifying name, isn't it? It sounds like a hard-wearing, acrylic, durable fabric.
And anyway, I did an audition to replace a young actor called Richard Burton, who was going to Stratford to play Henry V. So I went along for the audition. There were about 25 or 30 blokes, and finally we were all weeded out, and I was asked to stay behind. This tall, bald man came down. He said, "I'm John Gielgud. What's your name?" I said, "Ronald Faulkner, sir." He said, "Oh, my God, what a dreary name." I said, "Well, in Australia, I'm known by my nickname, Trader." "It's a Trader? Trader Faulkner?" He said, "What a wonderful name. Welcome to the company." And from that day, I dropped Ronald and became Trader.
Nice, nice. And Trader, where did this come from? Were you a fantastic amateur merchant? Where does trading come from?
Dad distilled illicit whiskey in the bath because this was Depression, 1933. Yeah. Things were bad. So I got a ladder, got in through the bathroom window and filled five ginger beer bottles with Dad's Rattler's whiskey. Filled up the five bottles, took them to school and traded them. And, of course, all the kids got drunk and I was expelled. And
drunk children, you've got a new nickname, everyone's happy.
Yeah. Dad said, "I seem to have spawned a right little trader." And Dad died about 3 weeks later and I said, "I want to be called Trader." That's what my dad called me.
And we were promised a bit of gossip in your book. At least that's what Sir Peter Hall has said about you, Trader. I think we should launch into some of this. I feel like starting off, I mean, as all actors did in touring the country in repertory, right? This is something that obviously, I guess, still exists. But I mean, there's lots of headlines in the newspaper at the moment about the lack of arts funding. I wonder if this all still exists. I mean, this is presumably where every young actor cuts his teeth and gets to see the crappiest bits of England as well.
Yeah. Well, what killed the repertory system, which was the great way of training actors, what killed it was television. The theatre's what gave you training, because you had 2 weeks to learn a part. You were in a different play every fortnight, playing different characters. That's how Olivia, that's how Gielgud, that's how Richardson, that's how Schofield, who was at the Birmingham Rep. That's how all these guys got this variety, and they were able to play any
type of part.
Maybe it's overstating it a little bit, but I wonder whether there was a sense of it was a bit of a golden age of the voice.
Oh, what was a golden age?
You know, because people...
when you think Olivia, Gielgud, Schofield, Guinness, all those people, they really were... I think the young people today, they're terrific, because I knew... I put a show together on Garcia Lorca. Woman that played the female side of Garcia Lorca was Helen Mirren. Helen Mirren, Ben Kingsley and Alan Hard. We did it at Stratford. And little Mirren was absolutely wonderful. And I always remember when she was doing Hamlet, the most wonderful thing. Alan Hard was playing Hamlet. And Mirren had to show how she went mad. And it was superb. She was sitting with her knees together and suddenly the knees opened. And she just went like that. She just flopped. And you knew in a second she'd lost it. That was the moment you knew that Ophelia had really lost it.
Yeah.
I was offered a Hollywood contract, which I didn't take. It'd be death to go to Hollywood.
Do you mean? Because presumably that's every act. We always believe that's every actor's wish.
Celluloid jungle, you know. I mean, the people, you know, stars in Hollywood, how long are they remembered?
Maybe they just blushed at your nicknames and your jokes.
Oh, God knows.
What they're like in L.A.
I went to L.A. because I wrote the biography of the guy that trained me, Peter Finch.
Yeah.
I wrote to his biography and went to Hollywood to research it. And terrible place. I absolutely hated it. Yeah, they had such an idea of themselves. And because Finch had just died and he'd got the posthumous Oscar, the only man at the time that got posthumous Oscar. So I met a lot of very interesting directors and people like that. And I thought, what a jungle, what a dump. Because you're here today or you're here this morning and you're gone this afternoon.
Trader Faulkner, the man that was in repertory in Hull and said no to Hollywood.
No to Hollywood.
I like that. I wanted to turn to the book. This is how chapter 14 starts. This is the Oliviers in Stratford-upon-Avon. And Trader writes, the theatre's greatest lesson. If you want to succeed, keep your mouth shut and do as you're told.
That's right.
I see that. I love that. Katie and I were laughing about that before because we thought that's a great way to open a chapter. But anyway, this is the essence of theatre.
Well, I was...
Shut up and do what you're told.
Well, I didn't, you see. Being an Aussie, I kept never shut my mouth. But I went up one weekend to stay with Larry and Vivian at Notley Abbey, where they had their weekend, beautiful place. And Vivian said we were doing Twelfth Night, and I always remember on the first night of Twelfth Night, Vivian came down. We had to kiss because I played Sebastian, the twin brother, and the production was disaster. It was bloody awful. And Vivian called me down to the dressing room. She said, "Darling, how much are you paid a week?" I said, £25. She said, "Look, do you think you and I could linger on the kiss?" Oh, I said, "Viv, I'd need more money for that." And she said, "Well, what about if I paid you £27 a week?" I said, "Yeah, I think I could manage a longer kiss, darling." She said, "I'll pay the extra two."
Nice.
She was great. And I went to stay the weekend.
That should be a quote on the back of your book as well. Worth the extra two.
Worth the extra two.
Same Vivian Lee.
Vivian Lee.
That's all right.
I went up one weekend to stay with them, and Viv said, "Come on, come and sit down, pour me a gin." And she knew, she loved Peter Finch, as you know. And Finchie had trained me. And she said, "Trade, I must tell you, Finchie is a most marvellous lover." She said, "Finchie in bed," she said, "that is something." She said, "Larry is, Larry's a son of a parson." And at that moment, Larry came in and I said, oh, Larry, how lovely to see you. I said, "Can I offer you a drink?" He said, "Baby, in my own house, I'm perfectly capable of pouring a drink. I think you'd better go to bed." So I said, "Yeah, sure." And Vivian said, "Trader, stay right where you are. Don't move." Olivia said, "Trader, please go to bed." I said, Vivian said, "Stay right where you are." So I said, "Look, please." I said,
she was paying you the two extra there.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I went to bed. 6 o'clock in the morning, I suddenly woke up to find Richard III leaning over my bed. So I said, "Larry, what?" He said, "Baby, I think you'd better go home." I said, "What, at 6 o'clock in the morning?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How do I get home to Stratford?" He said, "You'd better walk, hadn't you?" And I said, "Oh, come off it." And Vivian had arranged a picnic to go to a place called Minster Lovell. And I said, "What am I going to tell Vivian?" He said, "You can tell her what you like, but I want you out of the house by 8 o'clock.
So I thought, okay. So I met Keith Michelle. I said, have you had your marching orders? He said, yeah. He said, I don't. So we came and done breakfast, and I thought, well, how the hell am I going to put this to Vivian? Because she said, well, I've arranged all the picnic trade. She said, we're all going to Winston Lovell. And so I said to Vivian, look, I'm terribly sorry, Viv, but I can't do the picnic. She said, why? I said, I promised to give a driving lesson to my people I'm living with. And she said, well, darling, you can, just ring him up. I said, he's not on the phone. She said, well, send him a telegram. I said, Larry, over to you. And Vivian suddenly looked at me and she said, oh, I think I understand. You've got to go. I said, I've got to go. And that was it.
We're going to finish on a bit of Christmas stuff. You come in suitably Christmassy attire. I'd like to point out to our listeners, a red beret, an amazing red cardigan, red trousers.
Red socks.
And red socks.
Not red shoes.
Not red shoes.
But don't go near the bull ring.
But they are tan. Yeah, exactly. We're not going to point you towards any bulls in China shops this afternoon. I wanted to know what happens at this time of the year. Can you be bothered to get out to the pantomime? Is this frowned upon by proper actors such as yourself?
No. Well, as an actor, you take anything.
You do it.
You take what you can get.
Yeah.
No. I don't frown on anything.
We're going to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much.
Trader Faulkner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And telling us about Inside Trader, which is the book which is out now. Thank you so much for bringing in a bit of cheer and some of those great stories from so many years in the theatre. And it seems like you've got that good Sydney sunshine in your genes.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here. Many, many thanks.
That was the mighty Trader Faulkner talking to me there on this Culture Christmas special on Monocle 24. After this, we'll be travelling to some more of the world's record shops. Stay tuned.
If you're looking for a present for a special person in your life, why not give the gift of a Monocle subscription? £80 a year brings you 10 copies of Monocle magazine straight to your door. Or for just £10 more, you get our large format winter and summer newspapers, Alpino and Mediterranean. Both subscriptions come with 12 months exclusive access to the online archive, include delivery anywhere in the world, and our stylish Rutote tote bag. Also, subscribers have advantage of a 10% discount off everything in one of our 5 Monocle shops, from London to Hong Kong. So head to monocle.com to pick up your subscription today.
Welcome back to this Christmas special of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, earlier we heard what the record shops of Tokyo and New York are recommending this festive season. And now we're off to Zurich and Sydney. Enjoy.
My name is Lucas Siedler. I am the product manager for CDs at Music Hook, this wonderful house of music in the center of Zurich. And I'm very proud to suggest to your audience what's successful in our shops and what can be recommended as Christmas present.
Look at the boys in the water. Look at the girls, they are the fathers. Is it because we are better?
I'd like to advise is by our Zurich-based singer-songwriter Sophie Hunger, who's becoming step-by-step a world star. She's famous in the States, where she's often on tour, and her last CD was in Germany in the jazz charts. That's why her music is not easy to classify. But at the end, she's a young lady with an extraordinary feeling for good music, and her poetry is significant.
Hi, my name is Leo. I work at a music shop in Sydney's eastern suburbs, and one of our biggest sellers this year is Red Suited Superman, which is a duet between Rod Stewart and Carice Eden.
If anyone can do it, it's Santa who can.
Carice won the Australian version of The Voice this year. She has a great, gravelly, husky voice, quite similar to Rod Stewart's actually, but they combine really well on a version of this new Great Christmas song.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening.
Australians seem to like their easy listening music for Christmas. Collections of standards and classics from people like, obviously, Rod Stewart and Michael Bublé has just released an album called Christmas, which is flying off the shelves as well. It's got versions of tracks like Silent Night and Ave Maria, but the one that seems to be doing really well this year is Winter Wonderland.
Sing a love song while we stroll along, walking in a winter wonderland.
But the biggest song this year, biggest Christmas song without doubt, is Mariah Carey's perennial classic, All I Want for Christmas Is You. It just seems to get bigger and bigger every year. It was written in 1994 by Mariah Carey. It's a modern classic. It's not a rehashed version of an old carol, which makes it even better in my opinion. It's such a great, bubbly, up-tempo song. Girls just seem to love it as soon as it comes on. I'm hearing it in nightclubs, coming out of shop windows. It's definitely Australia's biggest Christmas song of the year.
Well, it sounds like there'll be a bit of cheese on the barbecue this Christmas in Oz. Well, to end this festive special, we're going to travel to the place where it all began. We're only going to Bethlehem. Well, Bethlehem in Berlin. The Spanish conceptual artist Juan Garrabel is breathing new life into the city's architectural history. He's designed a recreation of the lost Bohemian Church of Bethlehem, heavily damaged during World War II and eventually demolished in 1963. Garrabel's 33-metre-high steel and light structure has been embraced by the city and plans to make the monument a permanent installation already underway. Our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, caught up with the artist on his home turf at his studio in the Spanish capital to talk about his Urban Memories series and why he thinks some buildings should never be forgotten.
It's very nice that this piece made so many friends by just staying there. I like to say that when I finish a piece, it's not anymore me that talks, it's the piece itself. And that's exactly what happened there. I'm very proud of having generated that energy.
If you could just describe the work itself, because it's in a very strategic part of Berlin as well, right near Checkpoint Charlie and right near where the Berlin Wall was. Why do you think it's such a significant piece of work and it's evoked such a strong reaction from Berliners?
Actually, this story comes from the 18th century. It's a story of the Bohemians that came to Berlin to get religious freedom, and the Berliners that encouraged that by building this church to them. I think that there are many factors that have generated this movement now. Basically, one of the factors has the roots in the history and the values, but some other factors have the roots in my beliefs in how should public space be used or be managed. I really believe in my language of steel nerves, not interfering with the square and not generating any impact. I just take the slightest piece of air for the use of evoking that building. It's a 31-meter high structure made of steel and LED lights, which generate the sensation of having like a sketch in the air. So it can be absolutely lived by the people. They can walk under the piece, they can just have a nap. It's very nice how they interact with it.
You mentioned as well that the photos don't necessarily do it justice, but what you like to focus on is the sensation that it evokes and the feelings. What kind of feelings would you want Berliners to feel when they walk through this enormous structure?
Apart from the typical feelings that are tied to this particular history of freedom and immigrants and so, physically what I want to transmit is greatness, generosity, the perfection. I just think that I look for perfection and I try to recover perfect moments of history, and I want to recover that and I want to express that. There's many talent devoted to work on misery and so and so. I don't have any of that. If I don't generate the beauty and the greatness, I just failed. And I think it's the most honest thing that I can do, because Otherwise, there will always be an excuse. If I did not get that impression from people, individuals, general public, you, I cannot tell any other story. I'm now working in a big public project in Chicago, which is one of the other 2-3 cities in which the criteria and the success with the public culture has been in the higher level. I have projects in Paris with the Palais de Tuileries. I have a project in Mexico with a big temple of Tenochtitlan in the Zocalo Square. I have some other projects going on, but it takes time normally to optimize them once even you have determined that this is really the project that is worthwhile. I am now fascinated for the project in Mexico, because I think that it's another approach to what is memories and sensibility. I mean, these pyramids were places where blood was a purifying factor, and I like to get into that mentality and transmit it, even if it's not obviously my mentality, your mentality nowadays, because blood is a drama. But it's extremely interesting to get into the head of people that consider it to die in those temples like the maximum honor and the maximum happiness. So I like to do that thing. I mean, it's a physically, it's also a very different way of working steel and color and light.
That was Juan Garadabal talking to Liam Aldous. And that's all we have time for on our Christmas special here on Culture. Next week, we'll be celebrating the best of the Culture show from the last 12 months. There was a lot to choose from, so lots to look forward to for that show. So be sure to tune in. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and the show was edited by Lolita Laguna. To finish the show, we'll have one more track from Tracy Thorne's neat and crisp and even Christmas album, Tinsel Lights. And this is that title track. Have a great Christmas, seasonal break, festive time, glass of wine. Thank you for tuning in. Run, Rudolph, run.